Welcome back to Is It Horror? This is Season 3, Episode 13, The Mist.
I'm Joe.
I'm Matt.
And I am Steve. And unfortunately, Brianna won't be joining us for this episode, but should be back for the next one. And if you haven't joined us before, though, each episode we analyze a piece of media, usually a movie, whose horror status is debatable. We look at the creator's intent, audience reception, and the content of the media, all in an effort to better define the horror genre. If you agree with our take, that's awesome, and if you don't, that's awesome too. As always, horror is a diverse genre, and all are welcome. And before we get into The Mist, we will go to Joe's Get to Know You Corner, which is probably safe for The Mist for the moment.
Probably. Okay, well, so we're recording on April 1st, April Fool's Day. I know this won't release on April Fool's Day, but I just thought I was curious, what's your favorite non-malicious April Fool's prank that you have perpetrated or been the victim of? I work at a cabinet shop, and one of my coworkers kind of came up with a prank, and it's not like anything like, you know, groundbreaking or anything, but it's just sort of a simple fun prank where he kind of built a little box. And it's open on the top, and the bottom of it is angled. And then the front part of it, you can slide the front open or closed. And so what you do is you fill that with ping pong balls, and then you like go to a double door cabinet, open one door, put that box in, and then slide the front open so that the second cabinet door is holding the ping pong balls in place. And then, you know, when somebody comes in, opens the door, all the ping pong balls just slide out and go everywhere. So, I don't know, it's kind of a fun surprise, but non-malicious, nobody gets hurt, and you just have to pick up a bunch of ping pong balls. So, that's the one I've got to share for the moment.
For me, all that I could think of is, like, when... Like, my favorite thing that happens on April Fool's Day is, at this point, is usually, like, the different video games that I play having different, like, having events. And so I'll just name some of the ones that I remember that were more notable. So, like, Pokemon Go, the first April Fool's event that they had was... all the sprites in the game were set to, like, the 2D original sprites, and I thought that was really cool. Dead by Daylight has an event this year where they just made one of the killers really giant and all the survivors are really small running around. I thought that's pretty cool.
Which killer did they do?
The Oni. So it's this giant, like... you know, skyscraper-sized Oni running around the map chasing tiny little survivors. And then I also am on the site Imgur.com or Imgur.com. I've been on that for a long time, and they always do, like, a funny April Fool's joke every year. And so some of the ones that I remember is they did, like, a randomizer where you just post something and it creates, like, a random bunch of memes, and that's your post for the day. Or they have upvotes and downvotes, and they had, like, a meh vote, like, that you could do for one of the April Fool's jokes. So I always enjoy those things. I like when they make it, like, a mini event in video games or different websites.
That's interesting about Dead by Daylight. It feels like it would change the whole dynamic of the game a lot.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. It's. I think they balanced it pretty well. It's obviously not a game mode that has a lot of longevity to it, but it's just funny for the day.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, I might have to play a game of that to check it out. So I have been told by people that I seem like the sort of person that would pull a bunch of April Fool's pranks or just pranks in general, but I usually am not much of a prankster. I mean, like, I don't know, those that follow us on Instagram, there's the prank about doing the Is It Adam Sandler podcast. I thought about doing something today, but I just didn't come up with anything fast enough. But so I figured I would reference the weirdest, maybe. I don't even know what's the best, but the weirdest prank that's ever been pulled on me, which actually Joe is involved with too, which is back when we were in college, there was... So we had our apartment that was nothing but guys, and there was another apartment that was girls. And there was a couple of the girls in that apartment that liked a couple of us. And so they pulled this weird prank on us where they went and filled one of the toilets completely with ice and then put a live lobster on the toilet. And that was kind of weird. But then we tried real hard to see if we could keep the lobster alive, but we couldn't figure out exactly how one would keep a lobster alive as a pet. So we called him Little Snappy, and we tried to keep him, but it just didn't work out, and he died on us. And you would think that we would have just been like, all right, we'll eat the lobster, but we wanted to keep him as a pet.
Poor Little Snappy. I still feel bad about that sometimes.
Yeah, because, I don't know, it's like, we did our best once we were given... When life gives you a lobster, you just have to figure out how you can keep them safe and happy.
Yeah.
And sometimes I wonder, too, because you go by some of these places, so there's kind of like a Chinese grocery store down here that has a lot of fish and stuff like that. So they have like a huge lobster tank, like bigger than any lobster tank I've ever seen in a restaurant. And they had like full-sized king crabs, and they are not small, all just in tons of these tanks. And it looks absolutely horrible. I mean, like, basically they're waiting there for someone to pick them to kill them, and it's a horrible looking tank. And I think to myself sometimes when I see that sort of thing, is like, how did we not manage to keep a lobster alive, but they can keep one alive in this condition?
Yeah, that's a good point. Maybe it's not that hard. Maybe we tried overcomplicated it. I don't know what we didn't do or did wrong or what, but
yeah, I don't know. Snappy. Like, maybe we would have been better just keeping him on land. I don't know. We put him in like a cooler, and we tried to put like salt in there because I don't know. We're in our 20s. I wouldn't know any better how to take care of a lobster now, mind you. But yeah.
Yeah, I probably wouldn't do any better now, but I'm sure whatever we did was wrong.
Yep. Very wrong, because he died.
Everybody pour one out for the homie Snappy.
Damn, yeah. Skippy.
Well, if any of you out there in listener land have really good April Fool's pranks that you want to share with us, let us know. We'd love to hear about it. But in the meantime, thanks for joining us in the corner.
And now the mist has invaded the corner, and we'll start talking about the film then. And so the film was actually suggested as something we should cover by the Scare You podcast, so shout out to them. They actually also do a blog post periodically discussing the horror veracity of various films, so that's something to check out. And then The Mist originally released on November 21st, 2007. It's based on the Stephen King novella of the same name. And the film itself was written and directed by Frank Darabont, who had done other Stephen King adaptations like The Shawshank Redemption and The Green Mile. He'd also done the movie The Majestic, and then those who are zombie fans may know him from getting The Walking Dead TV show off the ground, although he was only involved with the first two seasons before tragedy struck, I guess you would say. Anyway, you could probably do a whole episode about all the legal... cases that have gone into The Walking Dead against the various creators, from the various creators against AMC. But anyway, we won't get into that. But yeah, so he's at least credited with starting that. And then the back of the box description for this movie is that after a mysterious mist envelops a small New England town, probably Maine, because it's Stephen King, a group of locals trapped in a supermarket must battle a siege of otherworldly creatures and the fears that threaten to tear them apart. Okay, so big spoiler warning for both the movie and for the book. And so keep that in mind. Anything about those is fair game to discuss at this point. So I have, first off, a fairly sizable quote here from Frank Darabont from an interview with MovieWeb. Could I get one of you fine fellows to read that quote?
I'm happy to do it. I will probably stumble over it, but to be fair, he is stumbling over some of his words too. So not all the stumbles are mine, just saying that up front.
Any stumbles are clearly just good reading on your part.
Right, exactly. Okay, so Frank Darabont, in an interview with MovieWeb, said, "The first law of physics, radiation makes monsters. Big ants. My answer to the question is, I love this stuff too. I mean, I have a common genetic predisposition towards loving these sorts of things. This is what brought me to this master's work in the first place, because I love this stuff. But to me, it's fun. It's the fun part. It's the trappings of. Is it a little science fiction? Yeah. Is it a little horror? Hopefully it's a lot horror. But ultimately, it's the core of the what makes him such a muscular master storyteller is the fact that it never just evolves into trappings. It's always about the human core of the storytelling. It's always about that journey of the human condition within his storytelling. That's what makes it particularly valid, particularly relevant. And the discussion earlier of fear, how does that relate? It's an examination of fear. It's an examination of people operating in a pressure cooker of fear where fear replaces reason. That's why I've always loved this story. It wasn't so much about the mist outside the window with the groovy critters in it. It's about what the people are going through inside the market. And it winds up being pretty real and pretty disturbing because there's nothing scarier than human nature and human behavior. That's why I thought the thing had some muscle. And it's about fear itself. It's what does it do to people? How does it wig them out? What does it compel us, or how does it compel us, does it bring us together? Does it tear us apart? Do we make mistakes? So we sail off a precipice. This is pretty meaty stuff for a filmmaker, and I can't thank you enough for letting me make the movie.
So I guess for a little extra context, I probably should have brought up is that Stephen King was also part of this same interview. So when he's kind of sounds like he's talking to Stephen King specifically and talking about the storyteller, that's because he's there in the room with him during the interview. And so I kept the whole thing in there because obviously he does talk about the idea of whether or not he saw it as horror. And he says, obviously, he hopes that it's a lot of horror, but it's also a little bit science fiction. But then also talking about just kind of the exploration of fear. So maybe giving a little bit of an indication of how he sees the genre as a whole. And then the other thing that I thought was kind of interesting about that is just dealing with human nature and the interplay between people in these stressful situations, which obviously is a big part of The Mist and something that we're going to talk about in terms of how it relates to this film being horror or not. So a lot of stuff covered in there, but yeah, all worthwhile to the conversation. So in terms of reception for this, we use a lot of times, we go to goodreads.com because any user can put what genre they feel a story is. The Mist is a little bit different in that it's a novella, so it was first published in an anthology called Dark Forces, along with several other writers' stories, so that wasn't a Stephen King-specific anthology, just one that his story happened to be a part of, and that's actually the one that Frank Darabont first came across the story in. And then later, it was published in a Stephen King-specific anthology called Skeleton Crew. And then with the release of the movie, then The Mist was published separately, I believe, in the sense of the book was marketed as The Mist and Other Stories. I can't remember exactly. I don't have that specific copy of it. But it's that book that copy of it specifically, that I looked at the genre selected by users from Goodreads. And for that, 67% said it was horror, and then every other genre was less than 10% each, but there were several horror-related subgenres, things like paranormal, terror, supernatural, monster, spooky, Lovecraftian, which don't necessarily all have to be horror, but they're very horror adjacent. And then some less conclusive genres, which would be sci-fi, thriller, fantasy, mystery, and suspense. So again, none of those had over 10%. 67% said it was horror. Then looking at meta tags, you have 13 sites all calling this horror. And in fact, there wasn't a single site that didn't list horror as one of the genres for this film. You have 9 calling it sci-fi, 3 calling it thriller, 1 calling it drama, 1 calling it suspense. As far as Google and Wikipedia search trends from users, there isn't any real bump in searches for it in October. But so there's no real pattern that people are thinking about around Halloween, which might indicate it's horror. Although in the last just like 3 or 4 years, it's become a little bit more commonly searched in Wikipedia in October, but not a large enough bump compared to other months to really say anything conclusive. And then we've been doing Google autocomplete recently, so just type in "Is the Mist" and then see what comes out. And the top ones are "Is the Mist Scary" or "Is the Mist Lovecraftian." And finally, we have been trying to do more listener polls to see where people come out on this. And 75% of the people that voted in that poll said that it was horror, and 25% said that it was not. And I will bring up, because I tried to reach out to a couple people to see why they said it wasn't, and we'll cover that in a little bit. But before we go any further, The Mist, is it horror?
For my part, at least, I'd say it definitely is horror. I will be curious to hear what the people you talk to, well, and if you guys say it's horror or not. I guess I don't see a lot of legs to stand on for to not call it horror, but I'm curious to hear that take.
I also feel that it's horror.
I agreed. So 100% unanimous that we all feel that it is horror. So huzzah, we're in agreement.
Yay.
So I wanted to see too, I didn't put this question in the outline, but how familiar were you guys with The Mist before this? I think that we've all seen it and probably all read it before, but I wanted to check.
I've seen it before, I think a couple times, and I have read the book as well.
I have seen it before, and I have also read the novella before.
Cool. And same, I had seen it, I think, pretty close to when it first came out, and then I read the novella after that. And it's one that I went out of my way to actually get the Steelbook special edition of that was released, I think, just within the last couple of years. I really like this movie a lot, so it's one that I revisit periodically. And then there was a Sci-Fi Channel, I think it was Sci-Fi Channel, but there was a TV show that they tried to do, and I thought, oh, that might be kind of cool, but I really just could not get into it. And apparently that was true of other people, because I don't think it lasted more than a season. But, for this film, what most sets the tone for the overall movie for you?
I think it's a couple things for me. One is, I think, obviously the mist itself and just sort of kind of the oppressiveness of it. But I think maybe more so is the lady, Mrs. Carmody, and just what she's about and kind of her deal, and just sort of seeing the extremes that people can get into with their beliefs and how that affects the people around them and how it affects an overall system and how it, you know, just what that can do to a group of people.
Yeah, I kind of feel the same. I think Stephen King, I have read, obviously, a lot of Stephen King, because you know that, but he's so well known for horror, but I feel that he's maybe just as, well, maybe not famous, but just as involved in writing stories about how normal small town people can kind of turn into monsters. That seems to be something that he really likes to visit in many of his stories. So I Absolutely. Think that's really the whole town, or the whole tone of this story is just that, of how quickly people can devolve into chaos in a stressful situation. And it's, you know, he does this in several other books, like Under the Dome, and it's really something that he does all the time. So I think this is maybe a prototype for that kind of thing for him. I don't know if I could say that, but yeah, that's definitely the main focus, I think.
Well, I think along with that too, it's interesting to see how he does that in books that do have traditional monsters, because as much as, say, the book It, as an example, has the has Pennywise there as the main antagonist, you also have people like Henry Bowers that he has to use to get to people, and Bowers's dad, and Beverly Marsh's ex-husband there, or I guess not ex-husband, but we'll say dearly departed at the end of that anyway. But, you know, it's, so even though that there's this monster, it's creates, he makes sure to include all of these people and have them as the monsters too. And I definitely agree to get that as a reoccurring thing. What is it? The Shining, I think, has the phrase that's repeated over and over again, that this inhuman place creates human monsters, I think is how that goes. Is that right?
Yeah, I think so.
Sounds right.
But yeah, I agree. I think the overall tone is the conflict of the people in the store more than anything. I mean, there's these creatures on the outside, and it's basically, the mist is really just a reason to keep them sequestered and uncertain. And so I think that sets the tone most for me as well. So we've talked a while back about how Stephen King is usually seen as a horror writer, and Matt, you brought this up too. The majority of his works tend to fall within that genre, but if you had no idea that Stephen King wrote this book that this movie is based on, would it still enter your mind to consider this horror? Like, if you just saw it in a vacuum?
I mean, I definitely would, because for me, there's a lot of suspense and highs and lows, and there's a monster, and, you know, people dying, high stakes. There's just pretty much all the elements of horror that I think about are here.
Yeah, that's the same for me. I feel like it's pretty solidly horror throughout. Like I kind of mentioned, like I'm curious to hear a take on why it's not, but I don't really see, I don't think it matters to me that it was, well, it does matter that to me that it was Stephen King, because I like a lot of his work, but as far as my genre classification goes, I don't think that really plays a big part of it.
Yeah, I think that even without knowing that it had anything to do with Stephen King, I would still see this as a horror film. And so I really only got one response back from someone who had taken the poll that was willing to talk about it a little bit. And what they said is kind of a thing that we've heard other places before, so this will be kind of familiar. I personally disagree with it, but I respect that opinion. That's fine if they hold it. I just personally don't agree with it. But what they had to say is that they viewed it as a sci-fi film, and that because it was sci-fi, they felt that it couldn't be horror. And they'd initially said that they thought that from what they remembered of the movie, that it involved there being aliens. So I had kind of pointed out that, well, I asked if they saw Alien as a horror film because I thought that was a good litmus test, since we covered that back in the day and talked about sci-fi versus horror as well. Because there was that lady who had her opinion out there that she said because it was sci-fi that it couldn't be horror. That was her opinion on Alien as well. And then, so I pointed out if the creatures, you know, would it change anything if the creatures were from another dimension or if they were created by magic? And so he still was of the opinion that it still fell into sci-fi, and that if magic was used, then it would fall into fantasy. But in either case, because it was sci-fi or because it was fantasy, that it wouldn't be horror. So I know we have talked about that a while back, but I guess where do you guys weigh in on that concept?
I guess I feel like they are not mutually exclusive. I mean, we've talked about it specifically on the Alien episode, but I think probably other places too. I think you can have some really good sci-fi horror movies. Alien is one of my favorites. And you can have some really good sci-fi fantasy movies too. horror fantasy movies. I think they can, both of those genres can mesh really well with horror. And I don't think saying it's sci-fi makes it not horror, in my opinion.
Yeah, I can see why people might think that sci-fi is the more prevalent of the genres portrayed in this movie, but I personally think that you can have both, and this movie to me leans more horror than it does sci-fi. I can certainly see calling it sci-fi though, because it has a lot of, you know, like the old sci-fi movies where you would go and it was a monster feature. This could certainly fit with that, I think. But yeah, I don't think that they have to be one or the other.
So I hadn't included this in the outline either, but it was something that I thought of when we did the Gunslinger episode, because it was part of the Dark Tower series, and there's this conversation between a couple of the characters. And of course, the Dark Tower series, for those that are familiar, is another Stephen King series. He considers his magnum opus, and it definitely mixes a lot of different genres. So it gets rather meta, and there's a meta sort of conversation in the fifth book. And I'm just going to go ahead and read that because I feel like it helps sum some of that up, at least in my mind. So you've got Roland, the gunslinger, talking to Eddie, one of his gunslinger proteges. And so it starts with, "Such stories are called fairy tales," Roland mused. "Yeah," Eddie replied. "There were no fairies in this one, though." "No," Eddie agreed. "That's more like a category name than anything else. In our world, you got your mystery and suspense stories, your science fiction stories, your westerns, your fairy tales. Get it?" "Yes," Roland said. "Do people in your world always want only one story flavor at a time, only one taste in their mouths?" "I guess that's close enough," Susanna said. "Does no one eat stew?" Roland asked. "Sometimes at supper, I guess," Eddie said, "but when it comes to entertainment, we do tend to stick with one flavor at a time and don't let any one thing touch another thing on your plate, although it sounds kind of boring when you put it that way." So I think ultimately that's kind of like summing up Stephen King's whole philosophy as far as genre is concerned, is that it's okay to mix genres and you can have more than one thing at a time. And I tend to agree with that. And I think it is interesting when you can mix those genres. I think there's some pretty good horror that you wouldn't get without meshing it with sci-fi, or that you wouldn't get without meshing it with fantasy. And as we've talked about on episodes talking about dark fantasy, you know, there's a lot of relation between fantasy and horror anyway. So pushing that a little bit further, I think, ends up being kind of a good thing as well. And just to maybe even pare it down with one more unfortunate analogy, if you were to look at, say, a Reese's peanut butter cup, it has chocolate, it has peanut butter, but I think that you would kind of be a little confused if someone said that it's only peanut butter because there's peanut butter present. So even the chocolate is now peanut butter, or vice versa. I just feel like that argument doesn't really work very well.
I think, the quote from Frank Darabont, I think, touched on this a little bit, but I think it really makes a story better when you can mix some of that type of stuff. And I think about some of my favorite horror movies are often are mixed with some other things. They're horror comedies, or they're horror sci-fi movies. And I think you get a lot more of that. You have more potential, I think, to get to more depth of character, kind of like Frank Darabont said in his quote, where it's not necessarily about the tropes, and it's, you know, you can dig into characters a little bit more. You can see the funny parts of their lives. You can see them cracking a joke, or you can, you know, see them falling in love or whatever. And it amplifies the horror parts because you care more about the characters, because I think you can dig into more of them as a person. Some of the horror movies I end up not liking as much are a little too focused on, I think, being horror movies, and they just feel a little shallow. They're often just about the gore and jump scares and things like that. And, you know, there's a place for those, and they're fun in their own way. But none of those are like my favorite horror movies.
Gotcha. Yeah, I could see that. I could see that in like the horror movies that we've watched together. And it's interesting always seeing like the ones that you end up really connecting with or don't connect with. So I'm always curious about that. Because obviously, like, I don't know, I'm ridiculously in it and kind of watch all sorts of stuff, but I know that not all of that always ends up playing well with you when I share it. Not that it's ever like gone terribly, just a thing I've noticed.
Yeah, and I don't know, maybe some people will be upset at me for saying some of this, and that's fine. But like, some of the things that jump to mind are like, I feel like Texas Chainsaw Massacre, for example, is not a movie that I love. It's fine, but I feel like, you know, it's trying to just stick to its lane for the most part and just be like, it's a horror movie. And I feel like, at least for me, I didn't feel like it didn't dig in the depths that I wanted it to dig, I guess. I'm not trying to say that it didn't have depth to it, because I think it does in its own way, but I just don't connect with that, like you said, as much.
Yeah, and I think that's perfectly valid. And quite frankly, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre series is not one that I personally connected that much with either. So I get where you're coming from in that. So yeah, there's, I guess, another reason to run at us with pitchforks, or maybe chainsaws.
Right.
So digging into the specifics of this film, I think, to me anyway, The Mist is basically the personification of the unknown. So does the complete uncertainty it represents already set a horror atmosphere from the film for the get-go?
Yes, I think so. I think it doesn't make it horror right at the onset. Like, just the presence of the mist, I don't think makes it horror, but it certainly like puts it on the path, I think. It does have that unknown, and that does have that horror taste or flavor to it. But it's not till you figure out that there's actually monsters in it, and until you start, you know, getting into the grocery store with the human monsters in there, that I feel like it actually is horror.
Yeah, I don't think that you immediately, like, yeah, the mist itself is the unknown aspect. So from the moment that the one guy comes running in and screaming about the mist, now you're horror. But I don't think it's horror before then. So yeah, it's I mean, the whole idea of the mist and not being able to see around you, I think many people find that scary just on its own, right? So, yeah, I think it's the mist sets the atmosphere.
Yeah, I think it's kind of like this ever-present uncertainty. It gives, in a way, it allows you to take a grocery store full of adults and allow them to entertain being afraid of the dark again, in a way, because, you know, the primal fear of the dark isn't the dark, it's that you don't know what's in the dark. And you can't, I mean, you could write a story where you just shut off the lights and all the characters exist with nothing but the lights out, and I'm sure that those stories exist, and I probably have even seen some that I'm not thinking of right at the moment. But I think that's ultimately, it feels like what kind of Stephen King is going for is, I want to have this group of people who can be scared of the unknown, and the mist is a good way to do that. And Darren Bont takes that and continues on that same theme with it. And so I think there's always that idea that that's ultimately what's really scary is the unknowable, which is the Lovecraftian element of all of this, beyond even just the monsters in the mist, is the fact that you can't understand or fully comprehend what is out there, even if you were able to see it, but especially because you're not able to see it. So I think that sets up this atmosphere that already starts to feel like horror as soon as it sets in, even before the interpersonal dramas begin.
I also think Stephen King is really good at just taking some base fear that probably he has experienced, or just he knows that other people experience, and just really building on it. You know, the fear of the dark, the fear of clowns, the fear of whatever it is, the fear of getting sick, of hurting somebody. He just will take some base fear.
The fear that of Kathy everybody Bates. Can,
the fear, some base fear that everybody kind of can relate with, and then build a story off of that. And I think that's what you see here. The mist is almost literally not being able to see beyond a certain point. That fear of that, the unknown of what's beyond where I can't see.
Yeah, I totally agree with all that. You can kind of almost see the gears turning in Stephen King's head for some of his stories. Like, you know, he was maybe driving through the fog one day and then this idea sprung up. I have no idea if that's what happened, but you can kind of just see that happening. And then he just turns it up to 11 and just sees where that will go.
I think if I remember correctly, there was an interview where he literally said he was just in a grocery store with his son when the idea occurred to him.
So being around people, not so much not being able to see things, just being around people is a primal fear. I can relate to that.
Same, right? No one likes being at the grocery store, and especially when there's other people there.
Or being at the grocery store and being afraid that somebody might recognize you and say hi.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You got to dart around the aisles for that.
I also think it's a pretty relatable feeling. And I don't know if I'm the only one that does this or weird for doing it. But a lot of times if I'm in a situation where I'm with a bunch of strangers, I sometimes think about, like, what kinds of interactions could I have with these people if I was stuck with them? Like, who would I be friends with? Or who would I not like? I do that fairly often if I'm in a group of people that I don't know for a little bit of time. So that this kind of explores that, actually.
So obviously there's a lot to say about people and what kind of threat they pose, and I definitely want to get into that a little bit more. But before we move full force into that, I wanted to talk a little bit about the creatures in the film. And so I wanted to see, what did you guys think about the creature design? And can you imagine these kinds of monsters existing in a non-horror movie?
Yeah, I can imagine them being in a non-horror movie. I could see it being a sort of sci-fi, exploring a different world sort of movie, that could be a little more action, bent, but it's hard to say. I think the character's design in conjunction with the mist, it's hard to imagine them not being in a horror movie. But I think it's sort of a thing where it's like, take away the mist, be able to see all the, you know, bug looking creatures flying around, and yeah, there maybe it does take away a little bit of the horror element. I think the design is really interesting because they're very alien, but they're also very, like, I don't know, kind of terrestrial based, I guess, if that makes sense. Like, they, you know, there's their version of spiders, their version of big giant stinging flies, and, you know, things like that, with apart from, like, the really giant creatures. At least a lot of the littler ones that we're dealing with, they're, you know there's the, it could, they could be, they're close enough to things that we could relate to, that I think that's interesting. But then it pushes it the boundaries with, like, the tentacle monsters and the big giant, you know, the, I don't know, the huge creatures that just sort of bends your mind a little bit, that are, they're just incomprehensible. So I guess, in short, yes, I think they're really good character or creature designs.
So just for the listener, you and I ended up watching this together, and I think we both came to the consensus that when the creatures were kind of against a normal inside, when they were against the backdrop inside, they didn't look so good with the CGI at the time. But when it was more practical effects, or when it was against the mist, things really popped. And I think they did a good job with them at the time. For me, the most iconic thing, though, is just the giant creature that they come across while they're driving. The scope of it is, like, really terrifying. There's a kind of specific fear related to that, like seeing really giant creatures,
megalophobia or something, right?
Something like that. And I think that this is, like, a super good example of that, of something that might terrify people to see something like that, or think about the size and scope of it. So that's always the one that I remember the most from this film.
And I think it's even bigger in the book, because they talk about looking up to try and see what those legs are connected to, and not being able to see high enough to do that. And of course, you know, you can go one of two ways with that, right? Is that if it's the same level of visibility as it is in the movie, that it's a lot bigger than the thing that they saw, or you could just go with the idea that the mist in the novella is actually a lot thicker than it is in the movie. But either way, that's still very unnerving, especially where we consider ourselves top of the food chain, and to find this thing that's so large that we just are nothing in comparison to it. We're not something it even takes time to think about or consider. I do think that the creature design in this, I think, is really good. I think that it's interesting kind of taking some stuff that we sort of maybe are primally uncomfortable with anyway. Things with tentacles, things with stingers, spiders in general. And then turning those into creatures, and then giving the spiders specifically, like, these skull-like, human-esque faces, kind of makes it all the worse, because it's one thing to see a giant spider, but it's maybe even another to turn it into some sort of almost warped body horror. You can almost picture someone seeing the silhouette of the face of one of those spiders coming out of the mist, and if that's the first thing they saw, maybe thinking it was a human and even coming towards it. So, I don't know. It's interesting, the idea of to think of maybe them coming from some alternate dimension where they've evolved to hunt humans that way. And then another thing I guess I thought of kind of off the cuff with this, and I think we've tackled this when we've talked a little bit about Half-Life, which relates to this because it's an inspiration for Half-Life 2. But does it matter that our characters are left with only more primal weapons to fend them off, right? Like, this would have been a much different film if we were at the military base, right? And everyone's got machine guns, shotguns, they've got artillery and armor to fend it off. But we're dealing with a grocery store. They have a gun, and then otherwise it's sticks and knives and fire. So does that affect the feel of the film in terms of it being horror or not?
It definitely has an effect. I don't know if I can quite say if I feel like it makes it more horror or not. I think you're right that it would make it a different film. I think it would be much more of an action film if we did have a lot more people with guns and things like that. I think it would still be horror, though, just maybe a little different flavored.
I think it raises the stakes that it's just this one gun. And I also think that just the one gun creates more of a sense of tension, because you're worried when, I forget what his name is. Is it Ollie?
Ollie, yeah.
When he's running around and kind of aiming at the creatures, and you're really worried that he's just accidentally going to put a bullet through somebody else. So that kind of adds more tension to it, just having the one gun, and having it somebody who's capable but not like a professional. So I think, and then also you're just more worried about everyone there. What's going to happen to them if they all were trained military people? And then they kind of quietly have the military people taken out. Like, they go, the two commit suicide, and then the other one, I forget what happens to Sam Witwer's character, but he dies too, right? So
he gets expiated.
Yeah. He gets snacrificed.
Yeah, he gets stabbed and then they throw him out. I forgot about that. But yeah, so it's one of those things where it does make you feel like everybody's more vulnerable because they have nothing to defend themselves with.
I think it definitely adds to the atmosphere. Yeah, I think that you can have a movie that was still horror and like have the military base thing, but I think there's always the idea of like, the easier it is to fight back against the thing that you're dealing with, then the less scary it is. So I think having our characters have a singular gun and only a little bit of ammo, I mean, like, that's the thing that every survival horror game understands, right? Is they don't give you a machine gun with infinite ammo. They give you a single gun, and you have to scrounge every last corner of the map to find one more bullet. And so the film, I think, kind of takes that same tact with it, and I think that it pays off. You know, same in the film as in the original story, because honestly the movie adheres pretty closely to the book, other than maybe a couple differences. But so I feel like it has an impact on the way that this story feels. And then the other thing is, so plenty of people die in this film, but most don't really get a quick death. People are cut in half, or they're eaten alive, or they're forced to incubate thousands of spiders. So do you feel like the focus, and maybe you don't feel like this is focus, but do you feel like there's a focus on human suffering when people die? And did that elevate the horror of the film?
Yes, I think so. I'm sorry, just thinking through that a little bit. Thinking through some of the deaths that were particularly bad on that, like the one, the MP who's incubating all the spiders, because he's alive and, you know, trying to communicate, but is also full of spiders, which is terrifying. But I think that they could have maybe cut out a lot of the horror by making the deaths more sudden and or off screen, and didn't focus on some of that. So I do think that that amped it up a bit, and kind of, I think you got a little bit more of the real and raw feelings of the situation because of the way they portrayed those things.
Yeah, I definitely think that it added to the horror because every death you were like real visceral, kind of almost looking in the eyes sometimes of the person that's dying. And, you know, from the outset, you have the kid that gets pulled out through the back room door, and you have the bloody gore of the tentacle thing ripping his skin off, and then you are literally looking into his eyes as he gets dragged off. So that definitely creates a lot of tension and a lot of fear for what's going to be happening to your main characters. And like Joe was saying, if that stuff, a lot of lighter horror will have those kills happen off screen or not show the blood, but this movie really went into it.
Yeah, I agree, and I feel like that's at least one of the ways, right, that you can kind of have a signal to the audience that your film is horror is by having more gruesome and elaborate on-screen deaths of characters. It's not the only way, and of course you can have something be in other genres without being horror and still do that, but I think that it's definitely in this film plays as sort of a signal to the audience that what you're dealing with is horror. Were you surprised by any of the deaths in the film? Because there's some pretty horrific things, and some of our younger characters are killed that we weren't expecting. You have kids die in the film. Were you surprised by any of the deaths? Were the characters that you thought were going to survive that didn't?
I guess, let's see, thinking back to when I first saw the movie, I certainly was surprised by the ending and kind of the suicide pact. And I have many thoughts on that, but I think we're going to get into that with some of the differences of the ending and that kind of thing. I was definitely surprised by some of those. I guess not many others, though. I felt like almost everybody was potentially expendable, with the, you know, maybe exception of our main character, the father, and his son, and maybe, let's see, not Andrea.
Yeah. Walking Dead reference for those that don't know.
Yes. I guess Amanda Dunfree is her character's name in this.
That's Laurie Holden. Honestly, if you've watched The Walking Dead the first few seasons, for that alone you need to watch this movie because, you know, Frank Darabont likes to work with a lot of the same people, so it's kind of a who's who. I always think it's funny because you see the lady who plays Carol, who, let's see, and her name is, I was trying to find her real quick and now I don't quite remember, Melissa McBride. So anyway, Melissa McBride is one of the random people in the story at the beginning, and when she like heads out in the mist knowing what Carol's character is like in The Walking Dead, is like, well, all the creatures in the mist are done for now.
Yeah, just look at the flowers, tentacle monster.
For real. They're toast.
So I kind of felt like they were trying to do something with Sam Witwer's character and the young cashier girl, and then to have them both get offed kind of, I mean, I wouldn't say unceremoniously because Sam Witwer's death was literally a ceremony, but they it felt like they were building something up with them, and then they just ended up both of them. Well, her death was, I think we're going to talk about it, but her death was particularly kind of gruesome, and the way that they have her corpse and everything. So seeing them get offed like that was, I guess, a little bit surprising. It's hard for me to say because obviously I've seen this film a few times over the years. If anyone was surprising, it was those two.
So I was just going to say that, well, we kind of already talked about the gore aspect of things and kind of like the brutal deaths to it. So if you had more that you wanted to say about her death, then you should go ahead and say it now.
Well, yeah, I was going to just say, I think hers particularly is one of the worst looking ones to me, because just the sting and the giant swelling, she sort of turned into like a gross out kind of monstery look herself. And if you are a fan of The Walking Dead, you can kind of see how this film translated to the Walking Dead. I think Frank Darabont is obviously a fan of having kind of gross out kills and pushing the limits of the effects that he can have on screen. So, and using that for the horror.
Another connection to The Walking Dead, as far as the effects go too, is the fact that Greg Nicotero of the, honestly, in horror, legendary K&B, he worked with Frank Darabont on this film on some of the creature designs and makeup effects. So, and then Greg Nicotero also worked on The Walking Dead doing effects, but also directing episodes as well. So there's that connection also. And then I think, to me, I was surprised by her death too, because I think one of the things you usually get in, and I feel like it ends up being a little bit of a fake out, intentionally so, is that in a lot of horror movies, if a couple is presented as romantically entwined in some way, then usually that signals to the audience that one or both of them is more likely to survive. So I think presenting them a little bit late in the game, they're a little underdeveloped, so that probably maybe keeps you from being sure, but then having them be developed by having a romance together, I think that would probably signal to a lot of people that they're more likely to survive. Now, of course, the fact that they haven't had that much characterization, some people might read it as, well, their plot's resolved, now they can die. But at least for me watching it the first time, I don't think I had caught on to that as a possibility, so their romance made me think that they were more likely to make it out. And of course, we will talk about the ending more specifically with the surprises with those deaths. Those kind of I wasn't ready for, and I think a lot of people probably weren't, as they're still talking about it all these years later. But other than getting to the end, I thought theirs surprised me, and I don't know that I thought Ollie Weeks was going to survive, but I wanted him to because he was such a cool character.
Yeah, he really was. He deserved a little more.
Yeah. So getting into the other side of it, so this story has the whole "the real monsters are us" vibe going with it. I have another quote from Frank Darabont where he said, quote, "The story is less about the monsters outside than about the monsters inside, the people you're stuck with, your friends and neighbors breaking under the strain," end quote. Which, obviously, that's the case, he kind of says earlier in the other quote that we had from him. But what do you feel like this movie is saying about humanity, and do you agree with it?
For my part, I guess I feel like I think that is the biggest focus of the movie. Is just the frailty of humanity or society. It makes me feel icky. I don't like it, but I can't say that it's wrong either. And you know, maybe in more optimistic times, I've felt times in my own life, I've felt like that sort of portrayal of humanity and people is a little too pessimistic. But then other times Trump gets elected, you know?
Yeah.
Sorry, we can cut out the political commentary.
No, it's fine.
Okay. But you know, just other times I am not as impressed by us as a species, I guess. It's a tough line, I feel like, to walk for my own personal sanity's sake, to just try and keep an optimistic look at us as a society and as people, but trying to also be realistic about people too. I really want to think more of people, and I usually can, and I usually do, but it's, you know, it's, you can't really take something like this and be like, this is totally, you know, people wouldn't do this. You wouldn't have a Bible basher like convincing people to sacrifice people. Like I'd really want to believe that that's not true, but I also have to try and be realistic a little bit too, and see people for what they are capable of sometimes. And it's sad to feel that way sometimes.
I think that this film, I don't know if it's trying to do that, but my interpretation of it is it's kind of talking about the lack of patience that we have as a society. Of we want things now, we want answers now, so we come up with anything we can to explain the unknown. And then on the reverse side of that is, you know, with the final scene of the movie, they take the quote-unquote easy way out of killing themselves rather than facing the mist and the monsters, because they think it's everywhere. And if he had waited just a few more minutes, the army would have rolled through. So it's kind of, I think, a commentary on patience, if that makes sense.
I hadn't thought about it that way before, but yeah, I feel like that makes sense.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think that's a really interesting take on that. That's maybe one of the things that bothers me about the story, especially the movie version of the story, is sort of that impatience. This whole story takes place over the course of a couple of days, like maybe like, what is it, like 2 or 3 days, and
something, you like know, that.
So it's, I think if I had a criticism of it, is like, I'm not saying that I don't think that people can devolve, but maybe that on that timeline, that doesn't feel super realistic to me. But you know, I guess maybe that's just part of the story too, though.
I don't know. I feel like it's saying, I mean, in Out and Out has that whole quote too that they attribute to Ollie Weeks, but I think it's basically Stephen King, right? Is, as a species, we're fundamentally insane. Put more than two of us in a room, we pick sides and start dreaming up reasons to kill one another. Why do you think we invented politics and religion? And I think, in a way, that statement, whether or not you agree with it, really sums up what the mist actually is more than anything else. And I guess I would like to disagree with it, but I think another book that's kind of a whole different animal is there's the John Dies at the End series. And if anyone's seen the movie or read the book, like, I know it seems real silly, but I think the second book's a lot better. And that second book is called This Book is Full of Spiders, which sounds even more absurd. But what it's ultimately about is the idea that if you can convince yourself that someone else is less than human, then that gives you license to treat them any way you see fit to satisfy your own needs. And I think that, again, more pop culture references, I think it's like the whole Men in Black thing. I think that an individual person, I think, is a little bit better than the Stephen King quote. I think an individual person can be a thinking person and weigh those things, but it's hard to not get swept up into a crowd of people that have deemed one group or another is the other, that they don't have to empathize with, that they don't have to concern themselves with the humanity of. And so I do think that if you got people scared enough, I think that this is a thing that could happen. I think that it hinges on the fact that it's a group that's mostly strangers to each other. I think that if you have a group of people that know each other better, then you could stave those things off. You could perhaps be more reasonable. But the fact that it's a grocery store full of strangers, I think, makes it worse. And in the real world, can make it worse. It's that element of being a stranger that helps these sort of atrocities get moving. I don't know. So I think that element of it for me also leads to the film feeling a bit more like horror. Just did your kind of views on it and what it's saying, I guess, also kind of lend it a little more towards horror?
For me, I guess that message, I think, was the most powerful part of the story. And it says a lot in a effective way, I think. But it wasn't, I guess that didn't make it horror for me. It made it, we've talked about this a little bit in recent episodes about, you know, what's a disturbing movie that, but, you know, is not horror, like things like Don't Look Up and movies like that, where like they're terrifying, but not horror. And I guess that's kind of what this element of this movie felt like to me. Like, it's terrifying because of the potential reality of it. But it didn't, that part of it didn't make it horror for me. It's just sort of the underlying current of it. It made it more real. It's again, like, kind of like we were talking about mixing genres, is like, maybe for me at least, like, that part of it isn't the horror part of it, but it's the disturbing genre, if you will. but mixed in with the horror, that but having that combination amplifies both of them.
I would say it's almost a trope of horror to be some sort of commentary on society or politics. I don't think it's
at
necessary.
Least a good horror, right?
Yeah, I don't think it's 100% necessary to make a film horror that it has those things. Sometimes horror is just horror, and sometimes you can interpret things that weren't there in the creator's mind. But yeah, it does feel like that's almost a part of all quote unquote good horror.
Would you say, when it's all said and done for this film, if this film never confirmed if there were creatures in the mist, so we never saw the tentacles, we maybe just heard characters say they saw it, we never saw the spiders or the bugs, we just heard characters say they saw it, would this movie still be horror if you completely removed the certainty that the creatures exist?
I think that really depends on what else you see. Do you still see the horrific?
You see everything mutilated? Else in the film as it is, but you don't. Well, okay, you're saying if you didn't, would you still see the after effects of the gore of the people? In this version of it that I'm suggesting, you wouldn't ever see the gory outcomes, people would just disappear. Maybe that would be all that it is.
Yeah, I think if you did it that way, it could easily become a psychological thriller rather than horror.
Yeah, I think so too. I feel like there'd be a lot less. Trying to put myself in the situation and being like, okay, well, am I trapped in here with these crazy people that might sacrifice me? Because there's almost certain death waiting in the mist. Or is it just like, I'm not sure what's out there. I might be able to get in my car and leave and it'll be fine. I'll take my chances that way. Like, the chance is a lot lower, I guess, as far as like psychologically going, that I think it would be for me at least, because it'd be like, well, I really have no idea what's going on out there, but I know that this place is crazy and insane and I need to get out. So I don't know. I think some of the like certainty of the horrors out there being there amp up the horror a lot for me, because they are really, like, with certainty, like, caught between a rock and a hard place, like, we might die either way. So taking or making that rock into mist, so to speak, just, you know, you don't know what's beyond the mist. I think maybe does dial the horror back a little for me, at least.
I think I'm on the same page. I think if you never confirm the creatures are there, then yeah, I think that changes what this movie ends up being overall. I mean, there's still some horrific things, some hopeless elements, some scary elements about what it says about society, but without the actual creatures out there and the confirmation of their existence and the gore from their interactions, I think that it becomes something different, becomes a different genre. So getting into the ending of it, I have another quote here from Frank Darabont, a lot of those in this one, in an interview with Y Entertainment, so I guess Yahoo Entertainment. I'm not sure how they pronounce that Y with an exclamation point. But anyway, he said, on balance, it seems like thematically it's a good companion piece to Shawshank in a weird way. Because if Shawshank is the movie about the value of hope, then The Mist becomes a movie about the danger of hopelessness. And believe me, I knew that it was going to be one of those endings that people either really dug or really hated. End quote. So, first off, in the novella's original ending, the characters, they just drive off into the unending mist and uncertainty. In Frank Darabont, he changed the ending to the decision to commit suicide, and only moments later, the mist recedes and the military is starting to get things under control, so that if the characters had only waited, they would have been saved. And then furthermore, you're shown that if David had just helped Melissa McBride's character, or potentially if he had helped Melissa McBride's character, he might have been safe. She's the one that you'll remember was in the grocery store and said she can't leave her kids alone, that she needs help. She asked the lady, won't someone help a lady get home? And no one chooses to go with her. And then at the end, after he's killed his son, the mist recedes, the military's coming in, she's shown on one of the rescue vehicles with her kids. So how does this ending and having such a gut punch affect your classification?
Okay. So for me, it doesn't affect the classification for me. I felt like the book was just as much horror as the movie. For my take on it, it just made me mad, really. For some of the reasons, we've already stated. You know, just about like what you said, Matt, about just sort of the frustrating look at the impatient nature of people and that type of thing, and just sort of like, well, I'm out of gas. I guess let's kill ourselves. So it didn't add anything to it for me other than anger.
So there's a lot of things to discuss there. I do like this ending more than the novella, because it's just a lot more interesting. Like you said, it is a gut punch. It's this one has a surprise ending, kind of a thing. And that's a Unbreakable reference to anyone seen the movie. And So I think that is definitely more interesting, although it's interesting for the movie format for it to have that ending. If you were writing a novella that could possibly become something that's ongoing, or it could be a TV series, I think it's interesting to have them drive off and see where they might go from there. But I liked it a lot. I think both ideas, though, are still horror, and I think that this particular way to end a one-shot movie was really the right way for them to go, because it's just really heartbreaking and it's memorable. That's all I have to say about that.
Do you think if everything had happened the same, but before the suicide pact is executed, like maybe they even They even make those head nods. They're all ready to do that. But then the military rolls in before anyone actually gets shot. And they're all rescued. Would you still consider this horror? Or is that upbeat ending suddenly, the mist has receded. We stopped the creatures. We all survived. Would that change the genre of the film for you?
It wouldn't change the genre of the film because we still saw like spiders burst from some dead guy's chest, and we, you know, still a lot of horrific things happened. It would still be a horror film. The tone of the film would definitely be slightly different. I'm sure Brianna would say have something to say about horror with a happy ending. Would it really?
She was here for this.
Would it really still be a happy ending, though, considering everything that they've gone through and seen and everything that's happened? More of a respite than anything else.
And they wouldn't have Ollie with them, so how happy can it be?
That's fair.
I think one of the things I think about with this ending, too, is compared to the book, to the novella. I don't think the novella, I guess if you just had that story, I don't think it's like really a particularly hopeful ending. And like, you know, even, you know, our character David, who's kind of narrating this and is writing all of his notes down about this, like says, like, I don't remember exactly how it's laid out, if it's like more of a narrator or if it's just his notes. But, you know, basically says like it's up to the reader to decide what sort of ending this is or something like that. But like, you know, the you've got two kind of contradicting things, I feel like, because in the movie ending, you've got like you have a hopeful ending with like a microcosm of like total tragedy, with like the father just killing his son, and like that is like the worst thing, you know, ever. But like it's being surrounded by this like, oh, the world's fine, the world's gonna get back to normal, the military's here and it's taking care of things, the mist is receding, and like the sun's rising, and so like you can see the like, I mean, not for our main character, but for humanity's, you can see the sunrise or whatever. But for in the novella version, it doesn't give you that that overall happy ending. Like it, for all you know in the story, like the world is enveloped in this mist, and there's no way humanity is getting out of it. So it's sort of a weird. I don't know. It's almost more tragic. It's almost more horrific, but not on the microcosm scale.
So would you agree with what Frank Darabont said, that this is kind of the danger of hopelessness? Does that make this feel this? Because there's different versions of hope, as we said, with each of those endings, the novel, that there's maybe some hope of safety somewhere, but maybe the whole world's covered, but or at least our characters are venturing into the unknown to face it, versus this one, the world's out of the mist in the movie. Maybe our character will forever be stuck in the mist, but at least there's some hope of saving the world. So I guess, does that work? The danger of hopelessness is the theme of this. Does the movie feel devoid of hope?
I mean, I certainly think that our main character fell victim to the dangers of hopelessness. Well, everybody in the car did, because they just couldn't see an out. But you know, that's one of the things that's why I kind of ended up feeling upset about the ending of, cause it's just like, man, there's so many different things they could have done. And, you know, in the book they find a place to hold up, and like he's figuring out how to get more gas in the car and how to carry on. But in this, it's kind of, again, back to what Matt said about just like the impatience of like, well, I'm not even going to try. I'm just too tired to try. Even though, again, really, we're talking about a couple, like, granted, a couple of days of absolute hell, But we're still really only talking about a couple of days, and they've just completely given up already. So I think that is a good analogy, like the dangers of hopelessness. I think that works for the story they were trying to say.
Yeah, because if they had just said to themselves, like, yes, we've got the suicide pact as an option, but only when death is more imminent. But yeah, if they had been more hopeful about their possibilities, then they wouldn't have, more or less, at least in terms of the way the movie presents it, jumped right to that as soon as they ran out of gas.
Yeah.
So, as far as just a review of the film, then, how did you like this film? How many loading dock tentacles out of 5 would you give it?
All right, I go. Brianna's not here. I usually don't go first on these things. I give the movie 4 out of 5 tentacles coming through the loading dock.
Yeah, I would say it's probably like a 4 out of 5 also. I really like it. I don't think it's perfect. But yeah, it's a pretty good film.
I'd even go so far as to give it a 4.5 loading dock tentacles out of 5. So one of those has been severed. That fifth one was severed in the doorway, I guess. But I think I would give it a little bit more if not for the ending. I know there's... I don't enjoy exactly watching the ending. I think it's a good ending, and I don't think that he should change it or anything. But I almost feel like the ending is so oppressive that it's comical in a way to me. Like, it skates that line real thin where it's just like, oh my God, how much more can you do to this guy? So that's kind of where I come off on that ending sometimes, depending on my mood.
Yeah. And I almost get like, I mean, again, like I said, like, it's like the most horrible thing that anybody would ever should ever have. They shouldn't have to. Nobody should have to go through anything like that.
No.
But you know, it's just, he's got like the, I see what you're saying about like, it's so far past tragic. It's so far deep into tragic that it's almost comical. And you know, you get that just like drop to the knees and like, oh my God, they blew it up. You know?
Yeah. Like, yeah. And I think it's like one of those normal human reactions. You get that sometimes where like something is just so awful that your only almost gut reaction is to laugh just because you don't know what to do with yourself. Do you laugh to keep from crying kind of thing? So I don't know. It just kind of like skates that line and it's just like, ah, man, if they just waited. But, you know, obviously that's the whole point of the whole thing. But I think that maybe I enjoy aspects of the novella better. I think I maybe like the novella's ending a little bit better, but there's definitely a lot more punch to this movie. And I think to a degree, if Frank Darabont hadn't changed it, we might not be still talking about this film.
Yeah, that's true. It definitely, it put it into the realm of almost controversy that I think keeps the discussion about it a little more relevant, or not relevant, because I think it's still relevant otherwise, but it keeps it a little bit more maybe in focus of the overall conversation.
Yeah. And then I wanted to just end off with a couple pieces of trivia that I think are interesting about this. We've talked about this in our Half-Life 2 episode that we did. So if you haven't checked out that before, definitely go listen to that. We've talked about Half-Life 2, the video game, specifically the second entry. But this relates a lot to the first entry, in that they had cited the mist as one of the inspirations in that story. In a way, you can view the first Half-Life game as what happened at the military scientific research complex where this whole thing gets started. And obviously it's a little bit tweaked from that, but that's kind of the impetus of that game's story. And then feel free to comment on that if you like, Joe. The other thing I was just going to mention real quick, though, too, is the Dark Tower connection, which one of the concepts presented in the back half of the series is Toadash space. And this is basically the void between worlds. And if the Dark Tower that serves as the nexus point for all worlds were to collapse, then Toadash space and all the creatures within it would come rushing into the reality of all worlds. And so another concept present in the Dark Tower series is also thinnies, which are holes in reality that can destroy those that come close, but are kind of at other times described as being traversable, meaning that, you know, you could kind of act as a gateway. So they look sort of shimmery, opaque, mist in circular form. So you can almost imagine Project Arrowhead accidentally creating a thinny that connects up to Toadash space. And then with nothing to stop them, all the creatures of Toadash space along with the atmosphere comes pouring into this reality. So basically the mist, as a short story, is sort of what's at stake for all of reality if Roland fails his quest to save the tower. So that's kind of at least how I personally see that connecting up. That's kind of my headcanon for it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have more really to add on the Half-Life front. Half-Life as a game series is one of my favorites, and sort of the mist kind of gets put in that like little box for me a little bit because it was the inspiration for, or one of the inspirations for Half-Life. So I like it because of that, and it's kind of fun to think about, you know, Project Arrowhead being, you know, the same type of thing, or that they would be working on at Black Mesa or whatever. I'm wearing my Black Mesa shirt for this recording, so awesome. There's that. I really love the Dark Tower references too. I think I am right there with you on as far as like the mist and the thinnies and things like that. And it's fun in the movie that like our main character is working on a poster, like painting a poster of the Dark Tower.
How did I not mention that in the connection? Anyway, yes, thank you.
Yeah, I think that's awesome. And even in the book, there's some things, because I read the book recently, and like he's just sort of listing off a bunch of kind of crazy things that could happen. And one of the things he mentions is like a singing rose. I think it's at least a subtle nod to the Gunslinger of the Dark Tower series. I love the interconnectedness of the Kingiverse.
For sure. And we did cover the first book in the series, The Gunslinger, so that's another episode you can go back and check out too. We've covered other Stephen King stuff like 11/22/63 and The Shining. So those also, if we didn't necessarily pull a Stephen King related thread that might have been relevant to this, it's probably because we covered it in those episodes. So definitely check those out as well.
Yeah, you could easily spend hours talking about how it might be connected to Stephen King. For some reason, it didn't cross my mind as much, because I, in my head, don't associate this with Stephen King the way that I should for some reason. But maybe it's just because I had only ever seen it as a movie first. It's obviously very interconnected, and it's a classic archetype of how Stephen King writes his stories, I feel.
And then the only other thing that I'll make mention of too is that, of course, there's a lot of different actors in this, but one of them is the late, unfortunately at this point, and great Andre Brouwer, who passed away just in December. A lot of people knew him more from Brooklyn Nine-Nine, but he also has a great performance in this one as well. So it's too bad that he didn't live longer. I don't know what he was like as a person, but it was fun to see another performance of his after having gotten used to seeing him, his persona on Brooklyn Nine-Nine, which is just great.
Yeah, I don't have more to add to that, just to echo it. Agreed.
I thought that his performance was interesting, and his was certainly like one of the ones that was focused on the idea of like he really immediately jumped to conclusions about like everything that was going on.
Yeah, for sure.
Trying to explain the unknown or not believe it or in denial about it.
All right. Well, I think that does about wrap it up for this episode. And so thanks for joining us on another episode of Is It Horror? Join us back here in 2 weeks, where we're going to be talking about our first Marvel movie that we're bringing into the show. We're going to be talking about Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness. So hopefully you'll join us back here for that. I have been Steve.
I'm Joe.
And I'm Matt.
And there's something in the mist took John Lee.
No.
That's why he's not here with us.
Poor John Lee.
Okay, bye.
Bye. Bye.
Thanks for joining us at Is It Horror? We post new episodes every other Friday. To stay up to date on all things Is It Horror, follow us on Instagram or X at Is It Horror Pod, or email us at isithorrorpodcast@gmail.com. If you're enjoying the show and you'd like to help support us, you can recommend us to a friend, follow and rate us on your podcast app of choice, or you can check out our store on Redbubble. In the meantime, stay safe and keep asking yourself,
Is It Horror?